This is the podcast that puts you at the pointy end of the airplane with two veteran airline captains. We'll offer insight into the pilot brain, we'll have some fun, and promise not to get too techy. Each weekly episode has a segment that provides inside information on what's really going on behind the cockpit door, and we'll discuss some industry current topics that might affect your travels. Your two pilots and co-hosts are Les Abend and Mike Strauss. Les has over four decades and over 25,000 hours of experience flying airplanes. The Boeing 727, 757, 767, and the 777 were all part of Les's repertoire before he retired. He was also a Czech airman. Additionally, Les still has the good fortune to be a 21-year contributing editor for Flying Magazine. He's been an on-air analyst and op-ed contributor for CNN, in addition to MSNBC and NBC, among others. And finally, Les is the author of Paper Wings, a mystery suspense whodunit thriller. Mike is a current A320 captain and Czech airman for a major airline with over 17,000 hours of flight time. In addition to his airline experience, Mike has a diverse general aviation background as an airplane salesman and a corporate pilot flying celebrities and VIPs. If you haven't done so already, please listen to the Welcome Aboard introductory episode. Don't get on an airplane until you've listened to Candid Cockpit.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Candid Cockpit. My name is Les Abend, and I'm here with Mike Strauss. And we will be talking about the unfortunate tragedy of this ATR-72 airplane in Nepal on January 15th. And how does this relate to operating in mountainous terrain, period, in the U.S., all over the world? Is this a dangerous operation?
For the cruise segment, tilt your seat back, prepare for a fun discussion on what it was like for Les and I to fly on our very first airline trip.
That'll be fun.
Do you remember that? That was a long time ago.
It really was. It really was. But I remember bits and pieces of it. Yeah, it'll be fun. And then finally, for the landing segment, we'll talk about the pre-flight preparation process. What happens? What's the normal protocol from the minute you walk into the airport till the time you go to operations, till the time you get to the gate, and then to the airplane itself? There's a lot that goes on.
Yeah, again, tip of the iceberg. It's, you know, people don't see much, and everyone thinks we just walk into the airport, walk onto the jet, turn the keys, push the button, and go.
Yeah, give me a cup of coffee, and then you're done.
Right.
But there's a lot more to it.
So. There is, yeah. We get cappuccino.
Yeah, cappuccino. Wow.
Folks, we've got a favor to ask. Invite your friends to a Candid Cockpit podcast. Send an email with suggestion or suggested topic to podcast@candidcockpit.com, and we'll mention your name on air. Really do like the questions because they give us a great chance to answer exactly what you want to know.
It's sort of feedback for us,
absolutely,
right? Yeah,
100%.
So please do that, and you know, like Mike said, invite friends to listen to. The more people we listen, the more we'll keep going with these episodes. Watch us make fun of ourselves right on camera, on YouTube.
On YouTube.
So we do have a YouTube channel, and turn to Candid Cockpit YouTube channel.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
So welcome to our takeoff portion of our episode. We're going to discuss what happened to Yeti Airlines, that unfortunate tragedy with the ATR-72 commuter that was attempting to land in Nepal, and you know what went wrong, what possibly went wrong, and how does this relate to any operation in high terrain, the Rocky Mountains, the Sierras?
Yeah, even the Appalachians. There's some tricky airports on the East Coast too,
and in the Caribbean.
Oh yeah,
there's one that I think you might want to bring up down there. So so what are the details of the accident? This happened on January 15th, as we mentioned. The airplane is an ATR-72. I think they had it configured for 72 passengers, and it's a turboprop airplane, a very reliable airplane. It's been used in the States for our regional carriers for many years. I've flown jump seat on it many times, felt very comfortable in it. It's, like I said, it's a turboprop airplane. For folks that aren't familiar with what a turboprop is, it's basically a jet engine that powers
a propeller shaft
yeah. To the propeller. So very reliable and as jet engines are. In any case, what happened was there is a video out that I think most of the world has seen, unfortunately, and it shows the airplane initially in what we call a high angle of attack. In other words, the nose was very high,
right?
Okay, relative to the horizon and the direction the airplane was going. That defines angle of attack. I'm simplifying a little bit, but what comes along with angle of attack is that it's very close to what we call an aerodynamic stall, right?
Right.
So the aerodynamic stall. May have happened there's also an interior video that's awful to watch, unfortunately. But in that interior video, it does show that the flap configuration wasn't quite at approach setting. So the airplane's angle of attack may have been too high for that flap setting. The flaps are that device on the trailing edge of the wing.
Slow speeds makes the wing bigger, allowing the airplane to fly slower.
Very good. Yeah, exactly. Good way of putting it. So there was the high angle of attack, and then all of a sudden you watch the airplane roll to the left. Right. And it got to a very, very steep bank, meaning that the wing level was not straight and level. And it got to the point where it was at 90 degrees, and that airplane can't sustain flight. And it can't recover from that. At that low altitude, especially. So, and it crashed into a gorge that is probably the only place that's not populated in that area.
Densely populated.
Yeah. And it was headed for a brand new airport. It was only open 2 weeks.
Ooh.
Yeah. It was 8,000 foot. It looked like a very nice area, but that's where they were headed. The other airport, they actually had a pass over the top of it. But in any case, the speculation at this point by looking at the airplane is that somehow it got too slow for the operation.
And the reason, and so the question is, why?
Why?
You know, pilot inattention, distraction, was there a mechanical issue?
Right. And that's another thing, and I'm glad you brought up potential pilot distraction from the standpoint of there's a record of the fact that the one of the crew members called for a different runway, which they were attempting to land
right.
on, which isn't a big deal. It might have been because of the wind.
Correct.
It was completely what we call VFR, visual flight rule conditions.
Right.
Weather was good, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
So that may have been a distraction to why they were setting up for the opposite end of that one paved runway. That may have caused a distraction.
Could they have been distracted and not paying attention to this? Somebody, basically, maybe somebody wasn't flying the airplane.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's almost a classic mistake. But listen, we're speculating.
Again,
we don't know.
Can't do that.
We have to see where the investigation goes, and the French version of the National Transportation Safety Board is helping Nepal.
Yeah, Nepal doesn't really have an aviation board like we have in TSB or the French or the Germans or the British.
Not that I'm aware of.
And the French are involved. Perhaps we should clarify this. Because the aircraft was a French-made aircraft. Typically, when an aircraft does crash, there's several entities that can be involved. One typically is...
Parties to the investigation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One is the country or place that the aircraft crashed,
right.
The manufacturer of the aircraft, the operator of the aircraft.
Right.
And then they may all call in somebody else, you know, that might have a little bit more resources to help investigate.
Well, if it's proven that, you know, if there's anything that leads to evidence of perhaps an engine problem, for instance, you know, it's a little far-fetched to me just from gut feel, but if we had an engine failure at low altitude and they added too much power on the good engine, it's called asymmetric thrust,
yeah.
And it may have forced that airplane to roll.
I doubt
that's the problem, but... you know, whatever it leads to, you know, it could be the engine manufacturer involved as well. And the French investigation unit is there just as an investigation unit. The manufacturer of the airplane should also be party to the investigation
as well.
They should
be. Yeah. And I don't recall what engines are on it. Does that have Pratt's on it, or does it have
Garrett's? I don't remember. I don't believe they're Garrett's. I believe it doesn't make any difference. But, at the end of the day.
Well, the reason I go there is let's say it's Pratt's, that could bring the Canadian government into part of the investigation because the Pratt's are made in Canada.
The Pratt & Whitney, it's possible. Those Pratt & Whitney is also made in Connecticut as well.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know if this particular engine.
If the parent is Pratt & Whitney, the parent is... Is Canadian anyway? Sorry.
The point is that anybody that has direct connection with the accident by virtue of the manufacturer of the airplane, engines, anything else, is given the opportunity to be the party
to be the party involved.
To be a party involved. Yeah. So, but that's basically the accident in a nutshell. What basically is to blame? Is it the news media kept bringing up high terrain?
Mm-hmm.
So. That puts a little bit of fear in people. High terrain, does that mean when I'm going to my ski areas and, to Vail, to all these places that
have airports in the mountains.
In the mountains,
Aspen's another classic
Aspen's
example.
Another one. Yeah, I had a little bit of a brain fart there because I'm retired.
Oh, well, you don't have to use your brain as much.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe you want to address that, Mike.
I own a property in Colorado, and you have flown into mountainous terrain with me to our place in Colorado, and we experienced...
I had my eyes closed, but yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. So did I. But, mountainous terrain creates a number of performance obstacles, so to speak.
Right, and honestly... Neither one of us mean to be cavalier about it.
No, not at all.
It's very serious.
It is very serious.
It takes a lot of planning.
And a lot of private pilots that fly in and out of mountainous terrain are smart to go take mountain flying skills training events that they can.
So can you expand on the environment that you might experience in mountainous terrain versus
a flatland? Yeah. No, and that's where I was heading is, again, the mountains, so you've got higher altitude, higher elevation, so to speak. You've got terrain in itself, so a lot of these airports could be in very small canyons that have certain ways to get in and out of those canyons. But then you add to that, mountains are typically, as wind hits mountains, it increases the speed. So you could end up with some nice wind acceleration through these canyons that can create turbulence, up and down drafts, things we call mountain wave. And you can see these mountain wave. We can be at 36,000 feet over the Rockies and experience some mountain wave. Is it unsafe? No, it's just uncomfortable and a little interesting because it just ride it out. It just kind of a shaft of air will take the airplane up a little bit, but then it'll come right back down. And it's usually not more than a few hundred feet, if that. Turbulence, obviously, typically over most mountain areas, it is going to be a little turbulent, especially the warmer in the day you get.
Right.
We all know turbulence comes a lot from heat, temperature rise. Then you add the winds in these tight canyons. I mean, there's a lot of things. And weather again. Weather in the mountains is a lot more interesting, and there's a lot more restrictions on runways, the weather minimums, the weather required to get into an airport, the weather required to get out of an airport.
Right.
Previous episode, we talked about a go-around. Well, at San Francisco, go-around's real easy. It's at sea level.
Right.
And we were pretty close to the ground when it happened. But in the mountains, you might be 5,000 feet above the airport when a go-around is required because of weather, wind, obstacle, obscuration. So the mountain creates so much more than just the flatland airports. Now, there aren't a ton of airports that are like this in the United States, but there certainly are a few. And unfortunately, there have been some accidents, both general aviation and airline accidents at some of these places. It's been quite some time since any of those have taken place. We learn from it. We train more about these in the simulator now for our recurrent training. Your airline and my airline, we both do a lot of flying to South America. So we do a lot of high, and there's a lot of South America, great another one, a lot of high altitude, and I mean very high altitude, airports that the commercial airlines fly into.
Right.
La Paz, Bolivia is one, over 12,000 feet high.
I believe 14.
Is it 14? Yeah, I know, I've never been there, but I do know that what it requires.
It was the only time that I got winded walking down the jet bridge. Yeah.
But that's one of those airports, and this again, it's a little bit off topic, but at high altitudes in non-pressurized aircraft or even in an airliner, If the cabin altitude is above a certain altitude, we have to required to wear a mask.
Right.
And if I'm not mistaken, La Paz, Bolivia, when you take off and land,
yep.
you have to do it with a mask, yep. with an oxygen mask on for Absolutely. Supplemental oxygen, because the cabin altitude, at some point in your flight, the cabin altitude and the elevation of the airport need to come together.
Correct.
You know, for the right. pressurization system.
Right. Because if you took off at a sea level altitude, and you're landing at the, where we're talking about La Paz to Bolivia at 14,000 feet, then at that point, you've got to get the airplane to that 14,000 feet. Otherwise, you can't depressurize
right.
when
no.
you get there. So, but more than anything else, this high terrain causes issues also on, you know, I think we're talking more about approaches, but on departures.
Performance,
you know, higher altitude is less dense air.
Thinner air,
correct. And the performance degrades, right?
Yep.
The airplane can handle it, but you have to compensate by reducing the load.
Right? Reducing the load, your weights, how long is the runway? Right. Am I too heavy for this runway? And a lot of those little airports might use regional or feeder carriers that operate smaller aircraft. One of the best airplanes for that type of flying is called a Twin Otter. It's a small twin-engine turboprop aircraft.
Like 19 passengers.
Yeah, and they can fly in and out of these little airports, and they've got great high-altitude performance because they're small, they're light, but they got lots of power.
I have almost 3,000 hours in a Twin Otter, and it's the only airplane you can shoot out of the sky with a snow shovel. Because, and I say that, you know, for our non-pilot people, from the standpoint of the wing is capable of high performance because the airplane can slow down to practically
nothing,
no speed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an amazing, amazing airplane, but that's very conducive to flying into those kind of airports. But one of the contingencies on takeoff, you know, whether it's an airplane of that nature, the Twin Otter, or what people are familiar with on a regular airliner, like a 737 or an Airbus, what if your engine quits?
Mm.
So you've got to have contingency plans.
Right, and that contingency plan is, as we talked about engine failure procedures at certain airports previously, is can the airplane clear all obstacles or obstructions
at the most critical time?
At the most critical time upon that departure right. on one engine.
On one engine.
And that creates, like you said, an entirely new set of problems or performance requirements in a mountainous terrain.
But to reassure everybody, that's already planned for. It's already baked into the recipe of your departure.
Correct.
Or your arrival, for that matter.
Yeah. On go-around. Like I say, Aspen's a classic example. You know, your go-around is 5,000 feet above the airport elevation because of the terrain.
Right.
And if the airplane didn't meet these standards, these performance standards for an engine failure at the most critical time, that airplane would not be allowed to go to that airport.
Correct.
So if the airplane's going to this airport and you're on it, rest assured, it can get you away from that airport safely.
Right. And yeah. and it's all about planning, really. It's thinking it through, knowing that the weather is unique in orographic mountainous terrain, and just understanding that what your performance is and what your out is. You know, on the approaches, they're set up, you know, if we use, I was very familiar, I used to do a lot of checkouts going into Vail.
Hmm.
And there were what we call step-down altitudes.
Correct.
So it would step down, get you just a certain height above the terrain.
Yep.
And then you would travel
another further distance. As the terrain descends a little bit in itself,
you're allowed to follow. Exactly. Yeah. And then the height above, like you mentioned, with Aspen, the height above the ground that you are committed to make that approach and be able to see that runway is very high compared to other airports.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Most airports, more flatland airports, 200 feet above the ground is where you have to make that commitment to the runway or not.
Yeah.
A lot of these mountainous airports, it's several thousand feet.
It can be. It can be. But as we relate to this particular accident, this unfortunate tragedy in Nepal, you and I don't feel, at least, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I don't feel that this was related to the terrain. This was some other mistake, I think.
I'm going to say that. And again, I don't want to speculate, but
it could be mechanical. I shouldn't say mistake.
So if you think about the terrain, yes, everyone thinks of Nepal as, oh my gosh, the Himalayas. They're 26,000 feet.
Mount Everest, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
I got close, so close to climbing that.
Yes, you did.
I got to base camp.
Yeah, that's another story for you.
But it's and it's kind of funny because you talk about thinner air performance on an aircraft.
Yeah.
Think about when you go to the mountains and you go skiing or you're winded walking down the jet bridge.
That's a great analogy.
That's the same thing the airplane is feeling, what you're feeling. I think this particular airport only had a 2,700 foot elevation, but which doesn't sound like much, but when you surround it by the Himalayas and the weather patterns, right. even though this wasn't,
right.
we don't think weather related in any way, shape or form, but it still creates new challenges.
It does.
You know,
it does.
So
anything else we want to add to this?
You know, no, it's tough. It's, you know, we learn to fly as professional pilot. You learn to fly in all types of conditions, weather, terrain, shorter, small airports, big airports, crowded airspace, little airspace. It's just, but we're professionals and that's what they train us to do.
It's all a matter. Listen, life is a risk, right? And we make this transportation business of aviation very, very safe compared to, you know, hopping in your car and getting on I-95, for instance. That's being said, there's risk and we have to acknowledge it, but we are very good at mitigating
those risks. And that's what our training is about, simulator training. Right. It's why we go to recurrent training every single year. Some airlines do once a year, some are 6 months, some are 9 months. It all depends on the program you're on with the FAA. But it's our job is about training, and always thinking ahead of the airplane. Yep. What if?
Exactly.
And that's where we can earn our pennies, is to do just that. Previous episode, we talked about my go around at San Francisco. I started thinking about that diversion as I left Kennedy,
right.
you know, 3,000 miles prior.
Right.
And it came to fruition. And because of that, we were ready for it.
Yeah. You were prepared. He was, your co-pilot was thinking, what do I do during, you know, he probably went in his head, what's the go around procedure and so on and so forth.
Exactly. So we do. We train for this exact, for these types of situations.
We do. Yeah. So, well. Hopefully we'll get some answers.
Yeah. Again, this is going to be, it's going to be some time before we get the answers, and learning will occur from these answers, and pilots will take these, everybody involved will take these answers seriously and apply them to the next time they fly or the next time they operate an aircraft or the next time they are involved with an aircraft in any way, shape or form.
Absolutely. Right. Very good. Good. Very good.
And we carry on.
On to our cruise segment. So what was it like for us to fly our very first trip as airline pilots? Because for me, it was the epitome of my dream. You know,
you got to fly with Wilbur, right?
You see, though, I always forget. Does Wilbur have the mustache? Or was it Orville with the mustache? Yeah. Oh. We'll leave that for our listeners.
Look on your certificate.
Yeah, I guess I should.
Because their picture's on the certificate.
It does say that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that one that I only have with me. Okay. Anyhow, so Mike, you do your story first about what it was like, but how you felt.
You know, I mean, I remember the leg. I remember the guy I flew with. I was brand new hire. I was getting ready to go fly my first trip. And it was scheduled for what's called operating experience. So my first time. Rich Fetchick was my my Czech airman.
You think he's wants to take credit for that?
He's still flying with my company. I see him every once in a while. Okay. I still blame him.
Right.
So we had to deadhead. We were assigned to deadhead from John F. Kennedy to in New York to Tampa. And deadhead, I mean they're just moving us in an airplane as a passenger to go operate an aircraft.
Right.
And we went down to Tampa, and he goes, all right, do your stuff. And I'm kind of sitting there going, I'm a little nervous. But, you know, I just come out of 30 days of aircraft training, or, you know, systems training and aircraft maneuvers, straight out of the schoolhouse. So you'd think I'd have been right on it and sharp. But when you get out of the simulator and you go to the line, which is why you fly with the Czech airman, you're nervous. I mean, it's the first time driving a car. You just got your driver's license, basically.
I think people don't realize that the first time you get on the actual airplane is with passengers.
With passengers.
Yeah. It used to be the first time you would actually take the airplane up empty
and just go do touch and goes or some maneuvers or something.
When I became a co-pilot at American Airlines, I went down to Midland, Odessa, and shot touch and goes.
Right,
727.
Interesting,
but not anymore.
No, it's you get on the airplane, you're the operating pilot. There's 200 people behind you, and off we go.
Yeah,
and again, this is where I give kudos to the instructors at the schoolhouse. They do a phenomenal job in getting you ready. You know, the first few minutes were a little nervous, but once I got into the groove, got my mindset, this is where I am, this is what I'm doing, you know, it went smooth. And again, all the training kicks in. We'll always talk about that. We train, hopefully never having to use a good portion of that training, emergency procedures and stuff like that. But it kicks in.
It does.
And off we went. Boring flight to Kennedy. Seriously, there's nothing to remember about other than we went to Kennedy. And I had Chinese food and got sick that night. There's that part.
Well, there's memories that, you know. But how was your landing? First landing.
We don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
Anybody we were able to reuse the airplane.
Okay. Well, that's one you can walk away from. There you go. Yeah.
How about yours?
Well, you know, mine.
How was your view?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So on a 727, it's a three-person crew, and the third person is the lowest ranking, and that's the flight engineer. So
sounds like the most important.
Well, it can be, because I can shut off the fuel to everybody else. Yeah, but anyhow, that's just wrong. But all the systems are on the flight engineer's panel,
right?
And you know, it is relatively. There's some complication to it, and you've got to do things correctly in the right sequence and. But you know, to me, just starting in operations and then knowing that I was now at that time, we actually really signed in, with our actual signal rather than doing it electronically on the computer, just knowing here I am reporting for my first day at my dream job.
Yeah.
And I remember I had other experience with other
airlines
prior to that, but it wasn't the same.
This is what you'd been looking for. Since you were 6 years old.
And I was doing it that day, right. And it was just... So we walked on the airplane. I was with a Czech flight engineer.
Okay.
And really relaxed, friendly guy. I was sort of deer caught in the headlights for just a little bit.
Yeah, I think...
Before I started anything.
Right.
You know.
So get that moment out of the way.
I was just trying to, you know, just take it all in and go, wow, I'm really here. And the crew was very welcoming. They always... You think you get these horror stories of you harass the new guy.
You're the new guy.
But they were great with me, and I can't even tell you where we were going. I just remembered that I did a satisfactory job. I didn't have to do a landing.
Right. You know. Yeah, lucky you.
Yeah, lucky me.
So. You know, and if you think the crew, yeah, there's going to be some, you know, we banter back and forth. You and I banter back and forth, and when you're in an aircraft, you know, with your flight crew, a lot of times there's some fun banter, but they're going to encourage you. They're going to encourage the new guy because they want to see you succeed.
And a good point in that, when you're the flight engineer, you're the closest to the flight attendant when the door opens.
Right.
So you're the one that hands the crew meal to the rest of the crew.
So you might be able to snake a little piece of the chocolate that they might, yeah.
So there's a little bit of harassment, but, you know, but anyway, yes, no, good point you made. Very good point.
Yeah, yeah, so it is. But yeah, I mean, first flights are always experience. You know, I'm flying with, as a Czech airman now, I'm getting the new hires right out of class, and they're coming in confident, but still a little timid. But again, once I watch them get past those first little bits of the flight or bits of operating, or even before they even get to the runway, you can see the confidence building back in them. And they do. It's just, they're like, oh, okay, this is what I trained for. This is no different.
Yeah. And it's important for them to get encouragement. I remember that as a Czech airman, you know, to be, not to be critical that first, that very first leg. But be, you know, be kind about it. If there was something that you saw that, needs to be corrected, but you need to be encouraging.
You do. Yeah, no. And I mean, that to me, that's the best motivation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Agreed. Yeah. Not much to our first trips. So long ago. Yeah.
everybody wanted to see if you would help us a little bit with just an easy favor. Invite your friends. We've asked this before, I know, and it seems a little redundant, but we really would appreciate it to have folks come on and watch the podcast. And then if you've got some things you want to add to a podcast, a topic, or you want to critique us, please do podcast@candidcockpit.com. And with your permission, if you like, we'll mention your name on air, whether it's a critique or a topic. And also, don't forget, watch us on YouTube. Yeah.
The TV stars were becoming.
Yeah, I can feel the Emmy now. Yeah.
Well, folks, here we are at their landing segment, top of descent, heading for the airport. And a good question a lot of people ask, what exactly do the pilots do before they get to the airport? What kind of pre-flight tasks do they perform once they're at the airport, before they get to the airplane? And, you know, it's not like you just walk out in your driveway, get in the car, turn the key, and off you go. There's things, and, you know, this brings up a good point. It kind of does start sometimes at home because, and you don't even, it might not even seem like a pre-flight, but have you ever gone on a trip and not looked at the weather a couple days prior for your departure and where you're going?
Yeah, most of the time I would say that, you know, maybe the night before I'll look at, you know, what I'm facing, especially if it was a potential snowstorm,
or, right,
you know, something significant.
Well, you want to pack right too.
Yeah.
So that's part of your pre-flight.
Yeah. 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 Well, there's that. Absolutely.
You don't want to get caught in Buffalo with shorts and flip-flops.
No, and I'll tell you what, you know, I listen to Al Roker. I'll tell you what, you know, if just give me a general view. You know, if he's got a big, ugly-looking face of thunderstorms out there, I will get into the details.
I'll look, look a little deeper.
A little deeper and see what I'm facing. But
we should tell Al that. We should get Al on here.
We should. So you and I will divide this kind of discussion up a little bit. So I'll take it from, we talked about home, so thanks for bringing that up. Mm-hmm. And then I'll take it from when I step into the door.
At the airport.
So. Yeah. So basically, honestly, it's stepping out of the employee bus and then to the airport. Because sometimes
you guys have an employee bus.
We
have to walk.
But yeah, yeah. It depends upon the airport. But at Kennedy, we had an employee bus. So, and that sometimes can be challenging when you miss it.
Oh, the air train is so entertaining.
Well, there's that. So we get into the airport and we walk ourselves to operations, which is buried sometimes upstairs somewhere in the airport. That's sort of concealed a lot of times,
right?
You know, both for security reasons and the fact that you know, we're away from regular airport operations. But we go in there. In my operation, it was just a banks of computers lined up, and it sounds like you have the same situation. And you know, if you run into somebody that you know that's on the trip, you introduce yourself. If not, generally, I would go to the computer. I pulled up my personal messages. There's an area that we could pull up, you know, various things that affect us directly, mm-hmm. As employee number such and such, and then I would go right to the crew list, which we get in our flight plan as well. But I would see, you know, who I was flying with. A lot of times I would do it the day before. Anyhow.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
Yeah. So you have an idea. If you don't know who the person is, generally speaking, it's sort of protocol that the crew introduces itself to the captain. I did care less.
Right.
If I knew who it was.
I've never had anybody call me prior, but I've made some calls.
Yeah. Well, I used to do it as a check airman. As a check airman, I would call up the person that was going to be on the initial operating
experience. Correct, yeah. That we do.
Yeah.
I do that every day.
Yeah. So, but that was the only exception to it. And you do that for the purpose of just sort of having a friendly conversation. Mm-hmm. What have you been flying? Are you new to the airplane?
You're not strangers when you get to the airplane.
Yeah. And listen, if somebody's new to the airplane, you know, you want to be able to discuss their comfort level and you size somebody up. If
absolutely.
You've never met them.
That's kind of what you're doing. You know, kind of, you mentioned as a check airman, you always call ahead and introduce yourself to do just that. Where they come from? What were they flying? How long were they flying? And then my company as a check airman, I always take the first leg of the flight, of the trip. again, to size up the guy you're flying with.
Right, right. Yeah. Majority of times I would do that. Other times I would just let them decide what they felt comfortable
right.
with. And the call is check airman, which is different than just being a line pilot or a line captain, was more to, for me, it was to put them at ease, you know, to say, hey, this is going to be an enjoyable experience. I'm there to guide, to help.
Take the intimidation factor out of it. Yeah. Because they may be thinking that, oh my God, I'm flying with a Czech airman. I've got to be perfect in every way, shape, or form.
There is some aspect to that. I mean, they do have to perform the standards. So,
absolutely.
You know, they're on a higher plane. There's a little stress level there. So you try to take it down a notch by giving them a call. But anyhow, that's part of it. So you sign in. From that point on, you can pull up your flight plan via the computer and get it printed out. These days, before I retired, and I'm sure you probably have it the same way, it goes directly onto your iPad.
Yep.
So you, there's no more paper.
We get paper for Waters or Orca overwater flying.
Overwater flying.
Okay. That's pretty much all we get paper
for. And that for us was a chart, you know, that just plotted your points across the Atlantic or whatever ocean you were flying on.
Right.
Or the Pacific, either one. So, yeah, all those things are available, and they're on the iPad, and it really reduces a lot of the cockpit clutter, I think. But I think we could still print it if we wanted it to.
And some guys do. I know some people that do. And, you know, maybe you're just more visual, and you want to write stuff down, notes on that iPad.
Some people are still old school about stuff. And what would come up with a flight plan? Well, the obvious, the route, right?
The route.
The altitudes that you're flying on that particular route and where it fits into your sequence in the flight plan, and then your performance data, which involves takeoff primarily, and then you know, a lot of it was what shut down our airspace system was the NOTAM, the notice to air missions.
All the
critical information there, so you read that to see if that affects
critical information about the airport you're departing from, the airport you're going to,
or airspace and nav aids.
Or airspace or nav aids. Exactly,
it can be pretty extensive sometimes, and there's a
quite
lot
lengthy.
Majority of it has already been out there for a while.
Correct.
You know, right?
Called an FDC NOTAM. We won't go into that.
We don't. We'll get into the weeds on that stuff. So you pull all that up. You compare it with the data. And here's one that's interesting. Got to see if you got enough fuel to get there.
That helps.
Yeah.
Just pull over to the gas station off I-95 at the rest stop and, hey, top it off, please.
So if you have a disagreement, you know, a lot of times you're questioning the weather. And so you get on the phone with dispatch. But, but the interesting thing about that is, how often have you ever got on the phone with your dispatcher?
It happens regularly. Not regularly, but I'd say maybe I might get on the phone with the dispatcher once or twice a month.
Okay.
Just to discuss route, discuss weather, discuss fuel. Hey, I'd like a little bit more. Or, hey, what do you think of this weather? Look at this route because this weather moved in. And there's chances the weather could have moved from the time they did the release to the time you actually are ready to depart.
And to help folks, the dispatcher is the one that's actually as responsible for the flight planning as you, as the captain.
Correct.
So we all have skin in the game. But for me, I talk with dispatchers maybe 10% of the time.
My percentage might be a little higher. Maybe your dispatchers were a little more grown up.
You know, there's a difference between flying across the North Atlantic and
flying to Syracuse. My light twin. No, but it's, and I, you know, and I like to talk. So I always, I'm always I think out loud a lot.
You should, if you like to talk, you should do a podcast.
That's a great idea. I wonder who I could do that with.
I don't know. So that's part of it. You might have a conversation with the dispatcher. And we generally had separate operations for pilots and separate operations for flight attendants, although it got integrated when I left. But if you have an integrated operation with flight attendants, you know, I'll try to find
the crew.
At least find, for us, it was the purser who was the flight attendant in charge.
Or the F1.
First flight attendant.
Yeah.
So I'll try to find them, and or they'll find me. And it's usually pretty relaxed. And then we head off to the airplane. The requirement was for us to be there an hour prior to departure. Most of us get there earlier.
Yeah, I very rarely. Well, you see the odd flight attendant or the, you know, show up right at report time or something like that.
Right. But, it gets a little hairy when that happens. But
Agreed. Most people do get there early.
Yeah. So that's pretty much what I remember doing in ops. If you've got anything to add to that.
No, that about sums up. I think that's probably pretty close to an industry standard.
There's one more. What gate am I going to?
Oh, right. That's important.
Because getting lost in the airport.
Oh, that's just so embarrassing. The pilot's looking around going like this.
Yeah, right. That's where you need this.
Well, this is where we could pay back some of our passengers.
Right.
Because they're always walking to you and go, hey, what gate am I at?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Gate 12. By the way, where are you flying?
Yeah.
So that's just before you even step out of the operations. Now you've got to go find your gate. Then you got to step onto the airplane and an entire new slew of pre-flight duties takes place. It starts with, okay, is the airplane powered up? Is the airplane not powered up? So that creates a couple of different checklists.
Before you even get there, what do you interact with the gate agent at all?
As little as possible at JFK.
We loved our New York agents, yeah.
Can we get
you don't want to talk about it?
Okay. No, you do. I mean, you have to, because they're going to check you in, not necessarily check you in. They're going to verify that you are flight crew for this particular flight. They'll usually hand you a release if there's a paper release, or they'll tell you usually how many people. They'll tell you if you've got any law enforcement officers on board, armed passengers. So these are all the things you need to pre-flight with them. Also, if the rest of the crew is there, are they not there? Who are we missing? Because they can assist in helping find the missing flight crew.
It's really good to coordinate with them.
Absolutely.
At least just most of the time, it's just a smile. How you doing? How you been?
You want to be friendly with them, because the gate agents take more heat from anybody else. One more time. The gate agents take more heat from people than anybody else in the airline industry.
Yep.
And I feel for them. They're not doing anything to make people delayed or late or canceled or seat duplications. It's not what they do. Their job is to help get you on the airplane as efficiently and safely as possible. And they do a great job of it. So a lot of times, I'll joke around with them a little bit about flying or something like this, and just kind of, take, like you said earlier, take away some of the stress.
Yeah.
And it helps. And then they're nicer to you when they're boarding, if they come to you with a situation.
Yeah.
I also give all my gate agents paper airplanes. Well,
very nice.
Well, so this is another thing, one more part of the pre-flight duty is, and especially since 2014, when new FARs came into play about crew rest and are you fit for duty? And you have to electronically sign that you are fit for duty.
What does that mean?
That I am physically, emotionally, and mentally prepared to operate an aircraft safely.
And you're rested.
And I'm rested.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the biggest part, yes. So we have to give we have to give the gate agents when they come down and close out the flight a copy of the piece of paper that we electronically signed and printed from the aircraft printer. I make a paper airplane out of it.
It's always good to have a personalized touch to things.
They'll remember me.
I was thinking a pizza would be better. But
okay. Well, I'm sure they thought the pizza would be better too. So you start. So now you're wandering down the jet bridge. Either you're doing it with your crew, because perhaps you met your entire crew at the top of the jet bridge. The aircraft isn't quite here yet, or they're still deplaning when you all get there. So that's one place to do. We always do a crew briefing. That's one place to do that crew briefing. If let's say, and I prefer not to, because public eye kind of appearance, doing a briefing, there might be some sensitive material in that briefing. But if let's say you're running late, or the inbound aircraft is running late, and you've got your crew and you've got them in as an audience, you might gather them in a corner, save some time to then allow more time to get people on the aircraft and have a better chance of making on time or closer to it.
So what, and I had the same policy. Matter of fact, most of the time I would just get the flight attendants in the first class section. And I would, if it was a 777-300, the stretch version, there's 13 of them.
Yeah.
And I would brief them, just about the basics of the flight, the weather, what to anticipate, how long, my policies, and it was a briefing, so it wasn't extensive. But
you added some bullet points,
and they enjoyed the communication. And I would never, if I'm in earshot of passengers, there's some security issues that have to be discussed. you can bring up what you discussed now, but I mean, I gave you a basic idea what I do. Is there anything?
No, pretty much the same thing. It's just bullet points, you know, flight time. And usually lose them right after that. They never hear anything after flight time. Right. So I have a habit of saving flight time to the last.
That's a good idea. And a good technique. I should have learned that one. But I mean, they're focused on thinking what they have to do.
Right. They're mentally prepping themselves for the passengers.
Stowing carts. You know, whatever they they all have individual duties that they have to take care of. Inspecting. You know, the medical kits and all that stuff. So that, you know, they're kind of focused on that. So sometimes I'll wait till they got those duties done.
And then a lot of the times, if I've gotten to the airplane and they're in the middle of that, I'll say to the F1, "Hey, when you guys are ready for a brief,"
F1 is flight attendant.
Flight attendant one. Yeah. Right. When you're ready for a brief, let me know.
That's wrong. Because
they're not going
to come up.
All of a sudden, you're boarding a mic. Passengers.
Yeah. But good luck with that.
Yeah. Sometimes it works. Yeah. I've stopped boarding because we haven't got a brief complete yet.
Yeah, me too.
It's important. You need to set the tone. You need to know what to expect from your flight crew, and they need to know what to expect from you.
You can. I mean, we were required to if nothing else, to brief the first flight attendant or a purser in our case.
Exactly.
And at the very least, I would drag that person up into the cockpit.
Correct, if you have to. If that's all you can get, and then they can go brief the rest of the crew. Yeah, because they have to do their own pre-flight briefing as well. Right. So that is an opportune moment if, you know, something's going on, or you've got something going on up front. You might be working a maintenance issue, or your first officer's helping you out, and all you've got is the F1 or your purser. You might go, "Hey, can we just, let's do our little thing," you know, so then you can move on to yours. We can get people boarded and on our way.
And a lot of times I would even go back, but most of the time they're not, you know, they're going to give the basics to the flight attendants, because trying to get them all on the phone at once, even the all call, it's just not going to get everybody all at once. But you know, you do your best. A lot of times I would go down the length of the 777 and introduce myself all the way to the back of the airplane. Because you never get to see them until you get to the end of the trip.
Yeah, and you might not even see them then if you're going to be the first guy off the airplane trying to catch a commute home.
"Oh, were you on my trip?" That's just the famous line. So, I don't like that. I prefer not to do it. But sometimes operationally, if you're in between gates or, you know, things are happening quickly, and you want to try to accommodate the gate agents to get people on board.
Yeah. You do what you need to do to get the word around that you need to get. Yeah. And I'm not, you know, I mean, granted, I walk down the tail end of a 321 is a little shorter than a 777-300, but it's a long walk for me.
Yeah. No,
I'll go out and I'll do that.
I was out of breath by the time I got back to the cockpit.
You're in better shape than that. But, you know, so yeah, you've got to get them in the loop. That way, if and when you do need them for a situation, you know what to expect.
You've got somebody's face in your head, and you have some confidence that they're going to help you. I think it's important. I got to admit, not every crew does that. Not every captain will do that. People are comfortable doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't always happen.
I've seen guys literally as they walk on the airplane, the flight attendants are doing their thing throughout the cabin, literally walk on the airplane, grab the handset PA and go, "Hey, I'm Mike, 3 hours, 28 minutes. Click."
Right.
And
where's my coffee? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, but, and it's, I just think you don't have that teamwork established if you do something like that.
So now you've talked to your flight attendants. Yep. Now you're going to climb into the cockpit. Talk a little bit about that.
That's where I take my little nap because it's going to be a really long flight. I'm tired.
People don't want to hear that.
Oh, but the first officer's doing all the work.
Yeah.
No. So, again, this is where this may be the first time you've ever met your first officer or your co-pilot.
There's no napping.
No napping. Definitely no napping. So you've got to do the same thing with him. Right. Now, typically, I'll include a co-pilot. If he's there and the flight attendants were doing a full crew briefing, I include the co-pilot because he may have something to input as well.
I do the same. Yeah. Absolutely.
But it might be the first time you meet him. So you sit down, you introduce yourselves real quick. "Hi, how you doing?" And you go into a what we call a pairing brief, which is similar to the flight attendant brief. The pre-flight brief is, "Hey, I'm Mike. I've been doing this for X amount of time. How long have you been doing this? Hey, you know, before I make any abnormal switch or lever adjustments, what it is, you know, I'll tell you what it is and why I'm doing it. If you don't like it, say so.
Right.
I got thick skin. I might be wearing 4 bars, but I've got thick skin. If you see me doing something silly or you've got a question about it, don't not ask it. You know, help me out. Be my partner."
Right.
Again, setting the tone. And then we go about doing the duties that each one of us has individually to get the aircraft ready.
Which is basically following a pre-flight checklist.
Correct.
So how do you divide those duties? And somebody's going to have to go out in the pouring rain.
Well, you just said it right there. Yeah, he's gone. No, typically with us, pilot flying or pilot not flying, which is pilot monitoring, again, two of us up front, one guy's flying, the other guy's monitoring, managing, so to speak. Pilot not flying, we'll go do the walk around. If that's me, I'll go do the walk around outside.
Right. I was the same way.
Yeah. Even if it's in the snow. And I took a tumble in Portland, Maine one time, and all I could think was, who saw that? And I'm looking up at the windows of the of the terminal. But so leaves him to do, we have what's called a receiving checklist. Anytime we walk into a new aircraft we haven't flown already that day, we have to do a receiving checklist. And it can be done by either the pilot flying or the pilot monitoring, or it can be done by the captain, done by the co-pilot, depends on captain's discretion. But if I'm going to go do the walk around, I'm going to let him do the pilot, the receiving checklist, which is an actual checklist, read and do. So it's, you can't, I mean, it's, if you read it, you've done it. Then let's say we're both sitting there. We've got our individual duties that are prescribed by the seat we're sitting in. I've got some things that I need to do, and it's called a flow, and there might not be a physical checklist to verify that it's done, but it's a flow. And these are one of the things we train on. So I'll do my flow.
Now, which is basically seeing the position of
switches and lights in the right place. Right. And typically items on that flow will get caught in a checklist down the road. There are going to be things you're looking at again.
Right.
I've got my flow. He's got his flow. Then it gets to who's flying. I just learned this. United co-pilots supposedly always load the FMS, or that's their SOP.
The flight management system computer.
With us, it's pilot flying loads the FMS, the flight management system, the computer that tells the airplane where to go. So that in itself is or individual duties. Now, let's say my co-pilot, it's his leg to fly. He's going to do that. My job is to verify. When I'm do it, his job is to verify.
There's a procedure that you follow for confirming you've put the right data entry into the computer. Exactly. So.
And there's a lot of data. There's a lot of data that you need to enter and verify, but a lot of it is verification on your own. And then the pilot not flying.
It's like any checklist. When you get familiar with an airplane, you know what has to be in the right, what position, switches have to be in the right position.
Right.
What data has to be entered. And when you get to the checklist part, you've pretty much already done it.
You've accomplished just checking it. You're just verifying
that you did it.
Yeah. Just verifying
it. So, yeah.
So there you are getting the aircraft ready. They're boarding. You may catch, someone may say something to you about something about the flight, or a gate agent may come down and say something.
Or you're dealing with a maintenance issue.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's going next. You're dealing with a maintenance issue. You might need maintenance on board to deal with it. And then and when you have a maintenance issue, that adds to your pre-flight duty, because now you've got a logbook entry you've got to make.
Right.
And then you have to verify that the mechanic either signed off the discrepancy as resolved, or is put out in what's called a minimum equipment list. And there are certain things in an airplane that you can fly without those items functioning exactly the way they're supposed to. Usually because there's a redundant system, a backup system of some sort, or it could just be a simple light bulb.
Right.
Or it could be a seat tray.
And then it's your discretion as a captain, whether you want to take that airplane. A lot of times that's never really an issue, but if you have multiple items that are not operative,
right,
on the minimum equipment list, multiple items, and it adds up into one big situation where this is broken, that's broken, and that's rare.
It is very rare.
It's rare, but you get to a point where you go, you know what?
Yeah, let's just fix not this. Comfortable. Let's fix it or get a new one.
Let's fix something.
Or another thing I do, part of the
pre-flight. These are small.
Yeah.
Items.
Engine doesn't work. We're going to fix that before we go fly.
Yeah. These are small items.
But, and sometimes you'll find part of the pre-flight duty is to review the logbook back to its airworthiness sign off. And you might see the same item every couple of days or every flight. Why does this thing keep breaking? At some point, someone's got to go, no reason for me to have to fill out paperwork when I don't. Let's just fix it or get a new airplane kind of thing.
Let's impress upon people, too, that it gets down to the last, you know, 15 minutes prior to that door closing. There can be a lot going on. If you got maintenance issues, if you got a flight attendant with an issue with a passenger, whatever it is, I mean, and then the normal stuff of checklist duties,
right?
You know, and if you got to the gate late, you know, if you're going through
a now it's compressed even more.
You know, somebody's running around. One of you is running around the airplane, not back in the cockpit. So, and you need them back in there to run checklists, and so it can get to be a pretty busy situation. And sometimes you just have to hit the slow button.
Hit the brakes, hit the slow button. Right. Yeah, you might be a few minutes late, but guess what? There's a reason for that. It's a reason because we want to make sure that we're doing everything the exact way we're supposed to do it to make the flight safe.
And if you know you're going to be late, what's the difference if you're another few minutes late?
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, that's important.
Rushing is not not in the pilot's vocabulary as a rule. We try not to rush.
Oh, and one of the things you brought up, just going winding back a little bit to briefings, a lot of times I like to know, you know, if there's another pilot on board. I like when they come up and say, hi.
Introduce themselves.
Especially if they're with another airline. So it's nice to know if we ever need extra help. And then my briefing with the flight attendants was oftentimes done with air marshals. So I would have them up. And because there's a security aspect to the briefing, I want them included to understand what I'm going to be thinking.
Right.
So I don't get a bullet in the wrong place.
Right, yeah, no, and it's true. And here's one of the things that's changed apparently with the federal air marshals recently was they no longer need to introduce themselves to the crew.
New change. Okay.
Gate agents know they're there.
Right.
But they do not have to introduce themselves to the crew.
Huh, but you have to know they're on board.
Not necessarily. Sometimes the gate agents will forget to tell you.
But you
should know that they're on board.
Right.
And especially if there's other LEOs, law enforcement officers that are traveling for business or what have you, and they're carrying a weapon on board.
Yeah, it's good to know.
You know, you go back to having another pilot on board. I had that happen where I needed the guy in the back. We call them also an ABP, able-bodied person. If you've got some sort of situation going on in the back of the aircraft, the flight attendants they're always sizing up their passengers. That, hey, if I got a situation, who am I going to go to ask for help?
Right.
And we had a situation, and when the flight attendant called me talking about the situation, I said, hey, you know, Andy Lewis is sitting in the exit row. Why don't you go tap him on the shoulder and let him know what's going on? Maybe he can help you out a little bit. And it is.
It brought him up to the cockpit?
No, I needed him in the back is where I needed him.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I needed him in the back.
There's a famous situation in Sioux City, Iowa.
There, Al Haynes.
Al Haynes. There was a Czech airman on board.
In the back.
And he got up and ended up in the jump seat.
In the jump seat. Operating the thrust levers.
Yeah.
Talk about being instantly becoming a part of the crew.
And I think he saved a lot of lives.
He did.
I think he saved a lot of lives. So, yeah, a very good point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Use all available resources, and it may be someone sitting behind you. Pre-flight. So, yeah, there's a, like I said, like you mentioned, there's, just to summarize, there is a flow of things you do. There is a checklist of things to verify that flow. There are checklists to verify that everything is in its right place. And before you close that cabin door, you got to make sure that all those boxes are checked.
Yeah.
You know, there's things we missed, you know, then you got to talk to Grand, you got to talk to Ramp, you got to talk to, you know, you've got to get power off the airplane, get new power on the airplane, which goes to, you know, how do we have air conditioning on board the aircraft in Phoenix, Arizona in July without the engines running? Another topic.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to it. You know, again, tip of the iceberg, you see us walk on the airplane, sit down and, you know, put some buttons in a computer and off we go. A little bit more to it.
Yeah. I think people had the idea that there was a little bit more than that to it.
But, I hope so.
But now we've scared them enough that they understand what we're doing.
Well, this helps them to, so that brings me to a good point. Nervous flyers.
That were scaring.
That were scaring people. Nervous flyers. I mean, and you think about it, on a serious note, a nervous flyer is nervous probably because they don't understand what's going on. You know, they're
It's a control thing.
Yeah. They don't have control.
Yeah.
So if you can alleviate that with our viewers, but also the passenger, the odd pass, you know, you see someone getting on the airplane, you can look at them and go,
right.
But that's
a whole other topic. You know, it's nice. I grab those folks. If they introduce themselves, tell me that. I used to grab them and just talk to them.
The reason you're nervous, you don't have wings. How do you fly without wings? I hand them
You hand them your wings. Very good.
But yeah, there's a lot going on. But believe me, everything we do is for safety.
Yeah.
I mean, it can't be understated.
Yep. Don't we take that seriously? Yeah. Absolutely.
It's our butts up there too.
Yeah, it's our butts up there too. Okay.
I think that's about it for pre-flight duties.
All right.
I think you're getting ready for post-flight duties here.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Captain Mike, I think we've wrapped up another episode. We're parking the brake, and JetBridge is coming up to the airplane. So I'm hoping that we gave a little more insight to folks.
Yeah.
On what we do behind that cockpit door. Next week, what we're going to do is discuss about how do pilots find their way around the airport and the taxiways and. Yeah,
that's why there's two of us up there. Yeah,
that's right. But we'll reveal that secret next week.
We will.
So,
and I'd like to just ask, while we're starting this checklist, just want to ask our listeners to get on their own PA, spread the word about Candid Cockpit to their friends and family. And I'm sure everybody flies. Everybody's got questions about it. So. Hopefully we can answer those questions for you. Send us an email to podcast@candidcockpit.com and we'll do our best to answer those questions or raise a new topic that we haven't thought of. We'll do that. Mention your name if you like. Take a look at us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We try to get as much information out there as we possibly can because there's a lot going on. There certainly is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyhow, thanks for joining us and don't get on an airplane. Unless you've listened to Candid Cockpit. Thanks again.
Till next time.
See ya.
Take care.